Short disclaimer. This podcast is in no way affiliated with the upcoming BBC production or Deborah Harkness. All views expressed are solely our own.
It begins with absence and desire. It begins with blood and fear. It begins with the discovery of witches.
Hello, All Souls fans. Welcome to episode 10 of the All Souls podcast. I'm Ginger.
And I'm Summer.
This week, we are discussing what, Summer?
This week, we will be discussing chapter 9 of A Discovery of Witches.
We have a guest with us again, thank goodness, to speak about this very awesome chapter. It is our good friend, Laura Ventura, who is here with us this evening to discuss Chapter 9, in which we meet her favorite character, our first official demon here. And so Laura, take it away.
Hi, I'm so glad to be here. Thank you for having me.
No, please. Thank you for joining us.
Now, Laura, we know you're a fan. That's putting it mildly. But what kinds of things do you do in the fandom, if you do anything?
Just
nothing much.
One little convention you might have heard of.
Just a little tiny one.
Yes, last year we had our first All Souls Con in Los Angeles, and I got the pleasure to meet you in person, although we met before. And I also run another site, a fan site called The Tenth Knot, thetenthknot.net.
You kind of freaked me out when you said last year. I'm like, no, it was like 2 months ago. I was like, holy crap, this is our first show of 2016, people. We're always growing, unfortunately. We're getting older, but time is going. I cannot believe it's 20. I almost said 10.
Oh my God.
Wow.
No.
2016.
Her statement has only been valid for literally 2 days.
Yeah.
But 2 days ago, that would have been an incorrect statement. But today, that is a correct statement. Last year was the first All Souls Con.
And it shows how, on top of things, our guest is. Because if we had recorded this pre-January 1, she probably wouldn't have said that. Well, let me ask one question. We're going to get into the details of the chapter pretty soon. But before we start, Laura, why is it exactly, why is it exactly that you really, really wanted to join the discussion of this chapter?
Well, in this chapter, there is actually one of my favorite, or maybe my favorite demon, Haymitch. And I just love this character. And I don't want to spoil the entire podcast. If I start talking about him, I will not shut up. I don't want to steal the thunder, but I just completely adore Haymitch.
Girl, you are the thunder this episode. So there's nothing to steal. This is your episode.
From the moment, from the second paragraph in chapter 9, the way, you know, he greets Matthew and onward, I just loved him. And then I will tell you why at the end of the chapter, I loved him even more. But don't want to steal this early.
Okay. So let's get started. In Chapter 8, we saw the disturbance in the forest that is Diana, the coming together of Matthew and Diana through the magic of Yoga and Amira, and then the repelling of our two protagonists at the end of the chapter, like a dance, apart, together, apart. But they are still on the dance floor. So Chapter 9 begins with Matthew driving through Lanarkshire, which is in Scotland. The landscape is of sharp contrast to that of Oxfordshire, and he finds this soothing. The description of the drive is so rich and full of history of the place. Previously, a palace had been there, and now an old hunting lodge. And we learn he is still in his Jaguar. Reader Ellen G. writes, "We have two hints as to Matthew's mood. Craggy hills and forbidding scenery."
Yeah, he's in a foul mood.
Yes.
He's having a really, really bad day, just to continue a theme that was in a previous podcast.
Exactly.
This is Matthew, really, really, really bad day. Yeah, so when he arrives, he's already in the worst possible mood, almost not quite blood rage, but, you know,
he's in a foul mood.
I mean, I think that he's been in a bad mood since he discovered Diana in the first place. Like, I think it's been consistently in a foul place ever since the book even was being whispered about.
So he gets there, he parks, and he's taking some bags from the trunk, and he walks toward the lodge, where he's greeted by one wiry demon with dark hair and twinkling brown eyes and a hooked nose. This is his friend of 20 years, Hamish Osborne.
Did you just put an H in front of his last name? Hamish Osborne?
No, I said Osborne.
Osborne.
Osborne with an O.
The lodge's welcoming white door opened. You look like hell. A wiry demon with dark hair, twinkling brown eyes, and a hooked nose stood with his hand on the latch and inspected his best friend from head to foot. Hamish Osborne had met Matthew Claremont at Oxford nearly 20 years ago. Like most creatures, they'd been taught to fear each other and were uncertain how to behave. The two became inseparable once they'd realized they shared a similar sense of humor and the same passion for ideas.
So Matthew is all vampire. He is drinking in all the smells. The house's smell of old plaster and aging wood. Hamish's smell of lavender and peppermint. Those are both excellent teas, by the way.
But I wouldn't think of them together, though.
Oh, no, not together. I mean separately. Well, I see what you're saying. I've never drunk a lavender tea, but I've drunk lavender mint. It's pretty good.
I've never smelled those things together.
It's kind of technically lavender is in the mint family. So they complement each other. So Deb tells us that Matthew is desperate to get the smell of witch out of his nose. And of course, this is Diana, whom he has gone back to calling witch. It's interesting to see, and we've talked about this in previous episodes before, it's in previous chapters, it's interesting to see how he distances himself from her with his language use. So their relationship status can be analogized using linguistics or language, as well as chemistry and yoga and dance, as we did in the last chapter. So his feelings may be there. I'm going to discuss them or find out more about them and their depth this chapter, as Laura was saying. But while his feelings don't necessarily change, they begin somewhere. We just become more aware of them throughout the chapter. The way he feels about his feelings, the way he's able to handle discussing her changes, and that is reflected in his use or in how he either addresses her or talks about her.
Well, and I think that in this chapter, I think that this is the first time that he kind of admits that we actually see, well, because, you know, everything else is really more, not from Diana's point of view, but more from Diana's point of view. So this is the first chapter where we get more of an insight into what's going on in his mind. And that we know that he's aware of the fact that he is hunting her.
Yes, and there's a better word for that, but I can't think about it right now. I can't think of the word. But the main tool, I guess you could say, for lack of a better term, that Deb uses to get us inside Matthew's mind is the tool of conversation, right? So putting someone, unless someone's going through their mind and having feelings, which is, she's done. We've been inside Matthew's mind a little bit. We've been in Deb's mind. We've been in Diana's mind, I think, more than his. However, when you're sitting with someone and having a conversation, in order to get those nitty-gritty details, that person that you're having the conversation with, if you're writing a scene, has to be, the closer you are with that person, the more you're going to share. So it had to be someone like Hamish, not just a friend of 20 years, but another creature.
But I also love the fact that it was very specifically not another vampire.
Oh, definitely not.
Which sets the tone for that character, because if he was just a vampire who only hung out with other vampires, it would have been even more of a breach for him to be entertaining and spending time with Diana. So the fact that
he couldn't admit that, absolutely.
So the fact that he's already, you know, really good friends with another creature that's not a vampire, you know, speaks volumes to his character.
Yeah, I think this I love this chapter exactly for that reason. It's one of the reasons, but we learn more about Matthew, the type of people he hangs out with, type of creatures. And later on, we learn about his past. So for a number of reasons, I think this chapter is pivotal in the discovery of witches. It really gives us the first in-depth glimpse into Matthew's mind, his past, the way his mind works. And even though it's through Hamish's eyes, again, I think this chapter is so important in the development. And there are some scenes that are also pivotal, but again, don't want to jump the gun.
So Jordan, Hamish's human butler, again with the smells of lemon, furniture polish, and starch. And this helps Matthew with getting the witch smell out of his nose, but it doesn't take care of all of it. We learn that Jordan is a very trustworthy.
So trustworthy.
I have problems with that word. Is very trustworthy. And he would never divulge his employer's demonness. Of course, that has to be the truth with any human employed with or employed by a creature.
They're so trustworthy.
So Matthew notices that Hamish has picked up a new painting by an artist, I believe named Hamilton. Since his last visit, he is looking around, getting his bearings. He's visited here. I believe we're made to believe they've been friends for 20 years. And I think we're made to believe that he's visited this place many times before. And you can tell, we don't necessarily know how often Hamish makes purchases, but it has been some time because there has been a purchase made and he's noticing it. So Hamish, like Matthew, his accent also sounds of Oxbridge, but of course he has a slight Glasgow burr, the sound of his roots. We're introduced to Hamish's new lover, Sweet William, who had been named after a flower of the same name. Now, Hamish, the reason he was mentioned is Hamish was supposed to spend a quiet weekend with Sweet William, but because Matthew had called him sounding kind of desperate, and because they hadn't spent much time together for a bit, he decided to come meet him at the old lodge.
Do you know, what does a Sweet William look like? Did anyone look at that?
I actually did. I got curious because I wasn't sure. And I actually, if you look it up, you've probably seen the flowers in flower shops. They're quite common. But I did more reading because I was intrigued about the name. And it's not clear if the flowers was named for William Shakespeare, inspired by William Shakespeare.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. And I also learned that, again, reading more, that the Latin name of the flower, Dianthus barbatus, actually means flower of the gods, which I thought, oh, that's really interesting. And I also learned that the flower is edible.
Oh, my goodness. So maybe we need to make that. Is it like edible, put it in a salad? Well, I guess that's what edible means, to eat.
If you can eat it, you can probably cook with it.
I didn't mean like in which way. What I meant is edible to like eat as is or cook, or edible, put it in a tea. I guess either way, it may not make a good brew. Tea brew?
Not sure about that, but
maybe put it with some lavender and mint.
I imagine if it's safe to eat, it's safe to drink.
Right.
Sure. I mean, yes, I think you're probably right.
Sure.
So this area, the area of the lodge, of Hamish's lodge, it's Cadzow Lodge, right? It is the area of the historic Cadzow Castle. And we did look, I'm not going to describe it, but we will share a link to historicscotland.gov.uk for this property in our show notes. It's quite an ancient place.
Where is it located? Like,
in
like near Glasgow? Did we go anywhere near it the last time we were in Scotland?
I cannot tell you that.
It's not far from Glasgow. I actually learned that it's a train ride, and I believe it's like a half-hour train ride. There is a train station right across from the entrance to the park, so it can't be that far.
So is there truly – I know there's a castle, and it's owned by Historic Scotland. Is there truly a lodge?
I believe the castle is the lodge. It's the hunting lodge.
Oh, I see what you're saying. Okay. So then, Summer, on our next trip in the spring, we may need to take a half an hour train ride outside of Glasgow.
Just and get lost pictures. In the middle of nowhere.
Go to the palace. Go to the lodge.
Is this a lodge?
We need to take a sign and say, make a few signs, right? I mean, take a sign and put just like white paper or whatever and roll it out or put on stick or something and pack it in our luggage that says, "Hello, Hamish."
There might be more than one Hamish in Scotland.
At Cadzow Lodge?
You never know. Hamish is not an uncommon name.
I understand that, but the point is, with the All Souls podcast, standing in front of Cadzow Castle with a Hamish sign, there's only one thing it could mean.
Well, to listeners, perhaps. I'm just saying, if we're standing out in the middle of anywhere in Scotland with a sign that says, "Hello, Hamish," we might meet some friends.
Oh, that too. I wouldn't mind meeting a Scottish friend or making a Scottish friend. Okay, so back to the story. Now, Hamish is alerted to something in Matthew once he's there, and he realizes that he needs to hunt, and very, very badly. Matthew refuses to touch whiskey, and so Hamish has some wine brought out for him.
Matthew's a man after my own heart.
And they retire to the library, which has a warm atmosphere. It was interesting. I didn't take detailed notes on every place, but each place, location in the lodge that Hamish chose to set them in had a different feel to it. And Deb took her time to describe each of those places, what it was like, if it had changed since its original building, and if there had been any like modern additions or modern changes to it, and what the atmosphere was like, and how Matthew and also Hamish, but mostly Matthew, felt in those rooms. It was very interesting. So in this place, it's the library. They go to the library for pre-dinner drinks, and there's a warm atmosphere, but with a warm wooden paneling, I believe she describes. Now, there had been some changes since in the 19th century, whereas the original architecture had been open and airy. So the ceiling was still original. It was white and bright, and this contrasted with the warm, cool darkness of the room below. So the room was originally also meant for women to hang their husbands.
What?
To hang out. Not to hang their husbands. For women to hang out while their husbands were outside hunting and doing sport. This is an interesting setting in which a demon and a vampire are to have a deep conversation. So we have the old and the new. The original intention was for the feminine, and now there's only the masculine in there. And it's a place originally intended for women to basically hang and chat. And now it's men who are there to hang and chat. So some things are similar and some things are different. And this is the first time I had, because the first few times I read this book, I didn't, you know, I'm not taking notes, right? So I'm not necessarily thinking, oh, I want to go look this up. Places, yes. Names and companies, not necessarily. So this is the first time that I made a note of the Barry Brothers and Rudd having been a source for Hamish's wine. And I looked them up, and they really do exist. And we'll have that link also in the show notes.
I am not remotely surprised that they have a brand of wine that actually exists, because
not a brand. The source, the place where he got the wine.
Right. That's okay. But I still am going to stand by my statement that I'm not surprised that it's an actual place, because
yes, absolutely.
Deb is very well versed in wine.
Yeah. Oh my gosh.
It's a great place. I've actually been there last summer when I visited London. It's in Mayfair. And it's next door to Pickering Place. That's the house where Marcus lives in the Book of Life. Sorry, I'm jumping three books.
It's okay. Okay, real quick. And then we really do want you to finish this and continue. Before we go on our trip next spring, in which we really do hope to spend at least a few days in London and Oxford and that area, we would like, since you are an expert in the books and you're an expert in book-related travel, at least for the Oxford, London, England area, because we're not going to have time to go to France or to Italy this time, or to Prague. But would you be willing to give us like a little cheat sheet of places if we had X number of days, like where to concentrate and go to?
Of course. Yeah. So for Oxford, I've already put together a guide of all the locations and how they relate to the books.
Oh my gosh, of course you have.
London is work in progress because it's huge.
I know.
I've already done, I think, three posts about London. I finished the Blackfriars, and then I'm going to do some other locations around the Blackfriars, and then I'm going to jump into Mayfair. So once I had to break them down into separate posts, because otherwise they would be way too long to read. But then I'm compiling a PDF with all the locations that you can bring with you, and you can see, you know, quotes that relate to the books and what happens when the people, when the characters are in the place. And oh, I had just so much fun doing it.
Oh my gosh. You need to go, you need to just basically go with us.
I would love to. My goodness. And for the wine store, I took tons of pictures. I went kind of maniac paparazzi. And I can actually, I've already posted the pictures, and I can just make the album public. So you can link from the show notes if you want to.
Anything and everything. Yes, yes, yeah. Yes.
It was so beautiful to see. Inside, it was like being in a jewelry that sells, place that sells wine. Like,
now,
oh God,
are these posts on the 10th Knot, or are they on the...
On the 10th Knot, yes.
Perfect. Okay, perfect. So we get the hint that just as Matthew is about to, quote, drag Hamish into all this... This may not be the first time that he has done so, because Hamish chuckles and says, with him, meaning Matthew, with him, it's always complicated, because Matthew's like, this thing that we're about to talk about, this is complicated. So because Hamish chuckles and says, it's always complicated with you, Matthew, we get the hint that while it may not be a pattern in their relationship, it is something that is, this is not the first time that they've had, definitely not this exact conversation, because there has never been a Diana, but they have this type of relationship.
Well, the impression that I got from that was the fact that if it's not complicated, he takes care of it on his own. So anything he brings to his buddy to talk out has to be something he can't handle by himself, which in and of itself means that it's complicated.
I really like this part of the chapter right after the description of Barry Brothers and Rudd, because it's the first time, you know, that this chapter explains why Matthew has been drawn to Hamish. And we get, you know, a little bit of glimpse into Hamish's character. And that's what I started to really like Hamish. And he, you know, talks about Hamish being very direct. And unlike most demons, he's level-headed and difficult to unsettle. So by this moment, I was deeply fascinated with this demon that is different from all the others.
Well, he's present in the world around him, unlike most demons who were like moderately out of their heads and in a fugue state, whereas he's like present. His little demon gift is like numbers and being like super smart with numbers. But I think that a lot of the other ones are more artistic, and that might also be part of why he's not in that fugue state that most of the demons are.
Yeah, and he appears like somebody very comfortable in his own skin. And, you know, Deb describes Hamish, you know, time that you spend with Hamish as consisting of long stretches of silence followed by blindingly sharp conversations. And he has this very serene approach to life. It's quite different from other demons.
Yes, and as you said almost verbatim, what set Hamish apart from other demons was his level-headedness and his evenness. Mm-hmm. So he was just as brilliant as them, but he didn't have the manic, seemed not to have the manic or depressive swings. Right. And he was thus able to, when you're brilliant and steady, you can accomplish a lot more. And I think if he had not been as steady, their relationship would not have lasted. May not have even formed.
But if you look at the rest of the demons we're introduced to, or they discuss, they're all either artists or writers. They're more artistic. Their gifts are more of an artistic nature, as opposed to mathematics and numbers, which are more black and white and clear cut, and they don't lend themselves to being...
emotional, really.
So I wonder if that led into the fact that he's not as crazy as most of the demons we come in contact with.
Right. And by chapter 9, we don't know too many demons. We know about Agatha Wilson, and we know about Timothy in the library and descriptions of other demons, or what Sarah Bishop tells us about demons. But besides the fact that Hamish is a demon, by this chapter, to me, his character is so intriguing. It's like, this is a character that I would love to have a glass of wine and have a conversation with.
Yeah, and something that, and again, we don't know a ton. We definitely don't know every demon out there, and we don't know a ton about a lot of demons. But something that Deb finds important enough to tell us, and thus we are to take note of it, although she doesn't say this is 100% why he is the way he is, but it definitely has to be taken, and that is his father was an insurance broker and his mother a housewife. And he also, so that may or may not have helped be part of his grounding. Having someone at home, having someone who was, I mean, you can be a brilliant insurance broker and be really good at what you do, but from what we do know, I think it's not necessarily 100% explained how demons spring up. I mean, it's rather random. Although you can have them in your family. So that can be, I could see, a blessing or a curse. A curse in that if you're one, especially if you're an emotional or artistic demon and your parent is an insurance broker and a housewife, you may have a very even keel home life, but you with this huge talent and huge maybe mood swings or emotional swings, you don't have anyone who knows what you're going through and who can help you. So you don't have anyone who can help guide you in a way. Whereas maybe with him, his imbalance, and I don't even know if you'd call it that, but his imbalance was being way too gifted and too smart for the classes he was in. And once he was able to be put in to correct placement, and had a way to...
He needed to be challenged.
Well, to be challenged, and he wasn't having to dumb himself down and hide what he was, or at least his mathematic genius. He was able to thrive. And I think because of the gift, his gift with numbers, and not an emotionally laden artistic one, that was a gift in and of itself, not having one of those. So I think that... not only making him successful in finance, made him successful as Matthew's friend. So their conversation starts out in a very interesting way. It's, as you said, Laura, he says to begin at the end, of course. So Matthew begins by saying he called Hamish because he, quote, needed to get away from a witch. So this one phrase makes it sound like he was being pursued or chased, which is very ironic, seeing as how he was the one doing the pursuing and the hunting.
And stalking.
And stalking.
And breaking and entering.
And Hamish, we learn from the text that Hamish is certain the witch was not male. Their conversation reveals Diana's unique name, being named after a goddess, and her lineage, or at least having the same name as a goddess. A witch, she was a witch twice over with a distinguished lineage. And then this line, she claims she doesn't use magic. Deb writes there were two threads in that brief sentence that needed pulling. Hamish pulled on the easier one first. And so even with this line, Deb is including her string or thread imagery again. So the first thread, did she or didn't she use magic? The second thread, why would she lie? We learn that Matthew can smell her use of magic. It's like an electrical storm about to break. And we already knew he could see it. She shimmers. And he even thinks he may be able to taste it. He names her witch's shimmer. I don't think we had this word before, but he names her witch's shimmer, and it's actually a word. It means shimmering. Is chatoiement. It's a masculine, le chatoiement, a masculine noun. Hamish calls him on it. Matthew was falling in love.
Yeah, so I love the description that we have here about Diana being like the scent. Her scent is like an electrical storm about to break or summer lightning. Mm-hmm. I remember Jennifer Ikeda, I think either at All Souls Con or during your podcast, mentioning how Deb almost writes poetry, and reading this chapter, it was, that's it. This is poetry. This is one of those vivid images that Deb is capable of painting so vividly. Kudos to Deb for this chapter. I mean, this paragraph alone, but for the entire chapter, really.
Well, the chapter, just like the last chapter, was very, you could read it and see patterns, but then if you step back, you can see the pattern or the shape of the chapter. This one, has, I don't know if you say a pattern. It may or may not have a shape. There may be one that I'm definitely not aware of, but you can definitely, as you're saying, you can see the poetry and the artistry in this chapter. And because she allows Hamish, right? She's not just mm-hmm. saying this happened and then and this happened and this happened. And I'll comment on this a few times in the chapter, but she allows Hamish to be the conductor. He orchestrates this chapter. Matthew may be the one who's causing it to happen, right? He's the one who's calling out for some kind of help. He's like, dude, my friend, I need you. I trust you. I know you're even. I can get this out. You'll be a sounding board. You'll help me get to the bottom of this because you are who you are. And I know I can trust you because you're a creature. And so he goes up to his place and because he's been there many times before, and he, as he always does with his friend Hamish, puts his trust in him and hopes to, I don't think, and we find in the end that this is the truth, of course, Hamish does not solve his problems, right? Hamish is a trusted friend and sounding board. And so Matthew has to do his own work, but Hamish helps facilitate that process. And he is a master conductor and orchestrator because he knows what Matthew needs. He needs distraction, he needs time, and he needs to get it out in his own way.
I think you're absolutely right. And I think Hamish is so brilliant. Mm-hmm. And it's because he's known Matthew for a long time. And it's because intellectually he's Matthew's peer.
Exactly.
I almost see Hamish kind of like doing psychotherapy in this chapter with Matthew. He has this introspection into Matthew's mind that I don't believe anybody else, at least up to this point.
I could definitely see that, him being like a friend psychologist, someone who leads discussion, because he is giving him like what a psychologist does, right? They lead you. They don't solve your problems. They help you get stuff out of your head and then will work with you to maybe then find solutions. But they provide a safe place and a private place. And they have the training, of course, to do so, to help lead the discussion and ask questions that you aren't asking. And it's through it's kind of like a tag team sport, right? It does take two, but it is, I see as a psychologist, at least in the form of Hamish, as a facilitator, someone who is there to help get stuff out of the patient, get stuff out of the friend, because the friend obviously has a problem or a question or a need, and he knows how Matthew is and what it will take to have him get out the information he needs to get out so he can face what he has to do. So it is time now for hunting. Now, Matthew wants to go alone until he can bring his craving for Diana under control. But Hamish tells him, nope, we're not hunting. Rather, they are stalking. And in the text, Deb says that the hunt is what defines vampires' identity, not the feeding and what they eat. So that was an interesting delineation she made. It's not the fact that it's not what they eat or how they eat. It's that they hunt that is their identity.
Yeah. It's also really interesting to learn how vampires don't like hunting with other warm bloods, including demons and witches. But Matthew makes an exception for Hamish. That already tells us Hamish is special. There must be a level of trust for Matthew to accept him, you know, bring him along during a hunt.
Absolutely. That tells us the acceptance and the trust. And because he may not be feeding during this time, but if it weren't for Hamish saying, nope, we're not going for a hunt, we're going to stalk. If it weren't for Hamish saying that, and Matthew respected it, Matthew could have said, nope, I'm sorry, I'm going to go do this. But he respected that and said, okay, you know, fine, let's go. If it weren't for Hamish saying that and Matthew respecting that, then I think he would have demanded that Hamish not be there, because I think Matthew, and I think it's Deb says it in the text, right, that Matthew allows or agrees to go out with Hamish because it is not a feeding. If it were a feeding, I do not believe he would have wanted Hamish there. So Ellen G. writes, step one, and she is referring to this orchestration that Hamish has planned. She says, step one, the hunt begins. And Hamish goes out with Matthew, except they were not hunting, but stalking. Hamish had a plan, keeping Matthew's mind busy until he opened up and said what kept him out of Oxford instead of Hamish having to pull it out of him. So this is one of his tactics to get him to relax a little bit, to get kind of bring down his high, if you will, bring down his anxiety.
But he's so brilliant because he knows that when Matthew is occupied with something else, then he lets his guard down. So throughout this chapter, he's using the same tactic to get Matthew distracted by other stuff so that he's able to divulge what's going on in his head.
Exactly. And at first, it's exactly
demonic.
I love that. It is.
Demonic. It's very brilliant.
It is. And that's part of his being his close friend, right? And part of the therapist act, if you will, or his role as a therapist friend, because he knows what he knows the tactic that works with his friend. He knows that if he is made comfortable through distraction, right, then if his mind is taken off of what is eating at him, he will open up. And that's what he has to provide. He has to provide those distractions. So after, and that would be part one or step one. So they return to the lodge, and this is the lodge that Matthew thought was an ill-conceived purchase on Hamish's behalf. But Hamish held it as a sign that he'd risen above his Glasgow roots, that he could even spend so much money on something so impractical and love it for its own sake. So here, I think you see a difference, another difference between the two. Well, of course, Matthew was human at one time, right? Whereas Hamish was never human. But I think Hamish's ability, and this is where I think it shows a difference between whether it were a human vampire or a demon vampire. In this case, it's a demon. But to me, it's a very human thing for someone to want to buy something or to be... This feeling that he has is a very human feeling, right? I want to be able to do this. It shows, at least to me, it shows me how far I've come from my roots, number one. And number two, that I can buy it just for the sake of loving it. Because Matthew does not understand this. All he sees is the impracticality of it. So this, to me, endears Hamish to me more. Matthew has beautiful things, right? He has beautiful things, but a lot of those things, like the old lodge, were things that were given to him and that he either bettered or, as Henry VIII said, basically you have to raise everything and then you can build new, you know, 500 years ago. But he has beautiful things, but he sees beautiful things for historical purposes or things that he's lived through. And it just so happens that since he's so old, that's why he likes them. Matthew is by no means frivolous or able to see. He does not hold the same reason for purchasing something as Hamish would. And also because, of course, his beginnings were so different. So Deb writes that Hamish moved on to the next step of his plan. I guess we could see his orchestration of the evening when he told Matthew they'd be stalking and not hunting. So he's already kind of calling the shots, like we said. So the next stage, dinner in the dining room. Matthew hated that room, but it was Hamish's favorite. That's another interesting choice. You would think if you wanted someone to be distracted and open up to you, that you may not choose their least favorite room to do that in. But actually, I actually disagree. I'm going to take back what I just said.
You're disagreeing with yourself.
Yes. If you want to make someone
That's
feel...
my job.
If you want to make someone... Well, there's two things. That's true. There's two things, right? You said, Laura put it, I think, correctly, that he is just... One thing Matthew needs is distraction before he will let something out, right? Or say what's bothering him. Not made to be feel comfortable, although the effect may be he feels more comfortable after he's distracted. However, here, Deb is actually saying that, or I think we can read into it that if you put someone in a place that they love, they're going to feel comfortable. Now, that may lead to them spewing stuff. But if they're in a place where they're not comfortable, they may be twitchy, but they're going to be hella distracted. So being distracted by being in a place that is not your favorite, and it's time for dinner, and Hamish is serving him wine and soup. That's another distraction, right? It's human. It's food. He doesn't always eat. Or always eat this kind of food. So again, it's more distraction. It's phase two, more distraction. Before dinner, they agree to play billiards for about an hour. And just as Matthew begins to be comfortable playing, Hamish begins the conversation. So that's another distraction.
I'll make the comment later on. You're probably going to talk about when they sit down and have dinner. And yes. I want to mention that Diane, who runs the blog called A Feast for All Souls, has a recipe for the sherry and mushroom soup, which sounds delicious.
Oh my, yes, we'll have to definitely, absolutely. No, that's a very good point. We'll have to give her a shout out.
Yeah. So, and disclaimer, do not ever read this book when you're hungry.
Oh gosh. That's true. There's such rich stuff in here. Oh my gosh.
Or thirsty, because it has you like craving wine.
Oh God.
You're like, oh, I'd love a glass of wine. Or toast.
So after they've been playing for a bit and Matthew had grown comfortable and distracted, Hamish begins the conversation. Where did you find the witch? The Bodleian, Matthew says. Hamish questions this and Matthew fouls his ball.
Whoa.
He'd been at a concert when he'd heard two witches discussing an American who'd gotten a hold of a long-lost manuscript, and he, of course, went looking for her. He said she even smelled angry. He smells everything. He tells Hamish that he'd barely seen her in the library, but had taken her to the old lodge to meet Amira, and he'd taken her to breakfast. We learn that Matthew had known women for years without taking them to the old lodge. Hamish insists it's easier to sit next to someone if you're interested in them, not across the room. But Matthew explodes. He says he's not interested in her. He wants the manuscript. Mm-hmm. So Diana is not the only one practicing profound denial.
Well, on the subject of being able to smell things, little tidbit I learned from Jerry Maguire. Dogs and bees can smell fear. So things do have a scent. And I'm sure most things do, I would think, because like if you're in a high stress situation, maybe you're going to sweat a little bit more, or you overpower your deodorant. There's lots of different special little aromas that your body could create in any given situation.
Matthew was also envious of Diana's ease at finding the manuscript. He continues to foul in the game of billiards in his agitation. It was time for drinks. Of course, they move on to drinks. Of course, Hamish had won the game, as expected. And Hamish tells Jordan, Professor Claremont is having a difficult day. I thought that was just awesome.
He doesn't realize it's been a difficult, like, week or two.
Or, yeah. And so LNG writes about... I have to go after dinner. Sorry. So they move into the old reception area of the lodge where they had drinks. It is still classical and very grand. Hamish here presses Matthew for information about the manuscript. He learns it's the lost book that creatures had heard of in legend. Matthew confirms he is protecting Diana from other creatures, namely from witches. Hamish calls him Matt. This, again, shows the seriousness of the situation as well as their closeness. He tells Matthew to leave her alone. And Matthew tells him, I don't think I can. I'm craving her. Hamish isn't surprised. Quote, a vampire had to desire another creature more than anyone or anything else in order to mate, and cravings were rooted in desire. He suspected Matthew was mating. He tells him he's hunting her, and he's relieved that it's out in the open, Matthew is. Matthew admits he's crawled into her window as she slept, followed her when she's running, and the more she resists him, the hungrier he gets. All this while Hamish is trying really hard not to smile, and that made me laugh because of what it is, and it made me also think of Laura smiling at her Hamish.
I also have to admire Hamish because I have such a glass face. I don't know if I could actually keep the Hamish's poker face. You know, if a friend makes a confession like that, like Matthew's.
I don't know if I have a glass face. I have probably a medium non-glass face.
You know, you have not. You do not own a glass face.
Because I'm pretty stoic. Oh my gosh. Stoic.
You trying to like pull one over on me? Like if she's trying to joke on with me, like I can tell by the way her face moves, I can tell when she's lying and when she's trying. She's doing it right now. She's trying. I can see it.
but I don't have a glass face?
No. No, you do have a glass face. I'm saying.
Oh, you said I didn't have one.
That's not what I meant.
Okay.
My point is you do not, you are not stoic enough. You cannot hide that. You can't hide things.
I can sometimes, but not, put it this way, I think it depends on who it's with, right? Like, my sister's known me 30-something years. She knows my face.
20,
oh, no, she's known me 26, 27 years. Come on now, I can go there. And, yeah, I would believe that. She's absolutely right. She knows my tells. But someone else that you've known for, what, a hot minute? A hot second? They're not going to know, unless you're like totally crumbling, right? They're not necessarily going to know your tells. So Matthew is not used to being resisted by women. He admonishes him, Hamish admonishes him, to think seriously before taking her to bed. Again, Matthew, while just having admitted his hunting the goddess of the hunt, is denying his urge to mate. Ellen G. writes, Hamish is Matthew's mirror, showing him the truth in what he is saying, how contemptuous he is of demons and witches.
Which is really ironic, considering the fact that he's best friends with a demon and he's trying to mate
wanting
with a witch.
Wanting to bed a witch. I know. So they have dinner. Over dinner, we learn of some of Hamish's youth, how he was gifted and didn't fit in. A demon from the University of Glasgow recognized that Hamish was one as well, and took his education under his wing. Once he'd confirmed this through the testing and helping him with his education, he'd visited Hamish's family home and educated his parents on what's what of creatures. Hamish's mother had also discussed with him that she knew he likely wouldn't be marrying a lady. Namely, it was the neighbor's kid, the neighbor's daughter. And he'd been attracted instead to the neighbor's son. And no one was surprised or distressed. It was simply part of Hamish. When Hamish had found out he was a demon, he says it was like being reborn. But he didn't truly believe it until after Matthew and he had become friends, the former smuggled him into the John Radcliffe Hospital. And while in the MRI, Matthew asked him questions. And he recorded the results of the MRI. And he had shown this to him, to Hamish, how his scan was in comparison to an eminent brain surgeon on staff there. And this, seeing this amazing result of his own brain helped Hamish believe.
I just love this description.
And isn't it beautiful?
It's so beautiful. It's so touching. And the fact that years later, Hamish still treasures Matthew's present, like it was the best present he's ever had for a birthday.
Oh, totally. It's sweet of Matthew. It's not just like, oh, I'm going to get you something. It's something that is tangible in that it's something that exists, but it's also an experience. So it's not just the what. It's the that he did it at all.
It's the that.
It's the that. It's the what he was able to deliver with it, the experience, the video, and helping him believe, but also be excited by what he was.
It's a turning point.
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely.
And I also love the fact that he can relate. He can feel the empathy for Diana because he says, Diana is where I was before that MRI.
Mm-hmm. And it's, and that kind of, you're right. And that kind, when I read that again, I, you know, it kind of, it, even though she's nowhere in the chapter, she's everywhere in the chapter.
Oh yeah.
And she is, you feel, this chapter's all about Matthew and Matthew's head. And of course, Damon. And of course, Hamish, the demon, whom we get to know. But by thinking of Diana in being in the same position that Hamish was at that moment, or technically not position, at the state of him pre-MRI, I think makes, even though we've learned more about Diana than anyone else in this book thus far, I think makes the reader appropriately feel more sympathy with her, because it's not just, she knows who she is, right? She knows of herself. She knows she's a witch. She knows who her parents were. There's no secrets. But even though we learn so much more about her in this book and then, of course, the next two books, having your main character whom you care for so much, or you're learning to care for so much because it's still early days, put in the position of someone who knows who or what they are, but truly doesn't know whom or what they are. It's sad, and it promotes this expectation now on behalf of the reader that, so what we may get from Deb is an awakening. Of course, that doesn't happen in this chapter because there's no Diana, but to learn about Hamish's awakening is so beautiful. And that, as you said, he still holds that as his best gift ever. And to think of Diana in terms of how Hamish was before he was awoken, it's very sad, because to have no knowledge of something, to be completely ignorant, is one thing. But to have knowledge but no power, or to have some knowledge but no true knowledge, I think is sadder than being completely ignorant of what you are.
Yeah, you're almost like in denial.
Oh my gosh. Well, denial, yeah, but you almost can't be in denial because you don't know what you truly are. So how can you deny it, because you don't know what the truth is?
Well, and unfortunately, I don't think there's an MRI machine for witches in existence today that would show your witch's power.
Oh. So Ellen G. writes, I like that Hamish thinks Diana is right on the cusp of learning about who she is. Hamish told Matthew he would have to win her trust in order to get what he wanted, which was to look at the manuscript. Well, that's part of what he wanted, although he doesn't admit it yet. Hamish also makes it clear to Matthew that if he wants, as Ellen G. just wrote, if he wants to spend time with Diana, he'll have to gain her trust. To do so, he'll have to tell her things he does not want her to know. Then Hamish redirects the conversation and Matthew calms. Hamish brings up the murders in Westminster. This is his redirect. Matthew's theory on this is that they are a sign that vampires are dying out. Now, we don't get a lot of information on the science yet, right? We're not getting a lot of this yet. But this is a common theme that we get from Hamish, where we get the sense in the chapter that this is something they've discussed, because this is a theory of his. And Hamish is thinking, you know what? He might actually be onto something here. And that is that vampires, as I said, Matthew's theory is that vampires are dying out. After dinner, they return upstairs to a sitting room where they play chess. And this is stage 3, or part 3, of Hamish's plan. Hamish was black and Matthew white. After an hour, Hamish moves into the final stage of his master plan here. He asks Matthew if he wants the witch for herself or her power over the manuscript. Again, this is the second time at least, and that Deb has used this word. Matthew explodes and says that he doesn't want her power. And then he admits he doesn't know what he wants. So here they are. Hamish has a plan. Wow, that's great English, Ginger. Hamish has planned the evening to get to the bottom of his friend's problem. Each time he has a question, he makes sure Matthew is distracted in some way. Hamish challenges him as well. I think you do know, Matt. He suggests love, to taste her, or to make you like you.
Make you like you?
Yourself? Is that better? Matthew admits only he will not give into his craving for her blood. He does not want control over her power, and he doesn't want to make her a vampire. And that leaves the option of love. Now, I get the feeling that something like this may have happened before. Hamish has helped Matthew get to the bottom of his pseudo problems or true problems, though certainly nothing spells a problem. It reminds me of Sound of Music.
Nobody solves
a problem like Maria, except I put nothing spells problem for Matthew like D-I-A-N-A. He says, you aren't afraid you'll hurt her. You've had relationships with warm-blooded women before, and you didn't harm them. Well, little does he know, he's about to get some schooling on Matthew by Matthew. Matthew's answering snapping of a crystal goblet answered that question. He explains, a woman named Eleanor, whom he was in love with, he and his brother were fighting, and she tried to make him see reason during the fight. She got between the two of them, and he ended up killing her. Now, this was ages ago. He doesn't tell us exactly how long ago it was, but when he talks about the second woman he killed, he said he wasn't an early-ish vampire. So that leads us to believe that the first one, Eleanor, was a lot closer to when he had first been turned. So the second person, woman he had killed, that he had been in a, I guess, kind of a relationship with, Cecilia Martin. It was just about a century ago. He'd wanted a taste of her, but once he drank, he couldn't stop. He barely stopped in time, and he ended up turning her. And she ended up not being able to stand being a vampire. She killed herself by walking into a burning house. Now, she had taken her own life. Matthew had not murdered outright either of these women by intent. And Hamish is trying to get him to see this. But Matthew, of course, has this. And this is something we're going to see for, I mean, book after book after book. Matthew has this guilt complex. He does not let this go. It is massive on him. It's probably his biggest issue. Now, Matthew had not felt this strongly, as strongly as he does for Diana, even for Eleanor. Ellen G. writes, step 3 was chess. Hamish asks Matthew what his endgame is, and then we find out about Eleanor and Cecilia Martin. Matthew doesn't understand the true friendship he has with Hamish, and that Hamish cannot see him as a monster like he sees himself. And that's what I meant by that big weight he carries. He sees himself as a type of monster. Now, Hamish won their game of chess. Matthew says, regarding the queen, the king just sits there, moving one square at a time. The queen can move so freely. I suppose I'd rather lose the game than forfeit her freedom. Hamish asks if she's worth the cost. And of course, we have to ask, was Matthew referring to Diana or the chess queen? Matthew answers yes. Hamish says, I thought so. You don't feel this way now, but you're lucky to have found her at last. So this is not a love, Hamish is saying, I believe, but the love, his mate. And Matthew doesn't deny any of this. But he does say, but is she lucky? And Hamish says, that's up to you. Hamish won the game. He checkmated him. And Matthew is as close to admitting mate as he'll probably ever be this early in the game. Long after Hamish had gone to bed, Matthew was still holding his queen protectively.
God, I love this chapter.
And that comes back. Like, the chess comes back.
I'm getting like, I don't know how much I've seen this. Yes, it does, Summer. Sorry to interrupt. I don't know how much I've said this in this podcast, meaning this podcast, like all the episodes. Did I get my first tear prick just now? Or have I said that on this one? Summer hates that term. But a tear prick, maybe I've said this. And if I have, forgive me. From now forward, I will not explain it again, but I will explain it now just in case. Laura, have you ever heard me say what that is?
I'm not sure.
Okay, a tear prick, what I call, and I don't know.
You're lucky. Your world is about to be changed forever.
No, what I call a tear prick is just...
In a negative fashion.
Laura's like, can I hang up now? No. No, a tear prick, what I call a tear prick, is that little tiny feeling you get in the top of your nose before you feel tears come on in your eyeballs.
Oh, yeah. The tingling.
Exactly.
Why
thank you.
Is that better? Tingling.
I don't know why I never did, but
tear
I can
tingles,
call it titter tingle?
Tear oh. tingles.
Tear tingles? That's too many syllables. Anyway, that's what I call a tear prick. And Summer hates it.
Hate it.
Anyway, isn't that just gorgeous? He comes.
Don't pause there.
The chapter begins with Matthew arriving. Is that better?
Sure.
At the castle, at this lodge, with nothing but Diana on the mind, Diana problems in the mind. And in the end, when he's kind of had a few come to Jesus moments with his friend Hamish through conversations and activities that only Hamish could orchestrate, right, to get him to this point in his friendly demonic fashion. At the very end, he's holding his queen protectively. So while he has, like Diana has been about magic, he's been denying all of this. He finally, I think, at the end, is accepting that he has found his mate.
Yeah. I also love the fact that Hamish tells him that he loves him like a brother.
Oh, absolutely.
After finding out that, you know, Matthew has accidentally killed two women, he still loves him unconditionally. And again, there's no way I can possibly love Hamish more. But it was really touching what he said. I can't conceive what you would have to do to make me hate you.
Oh, my gosh. And what a question.
Yeah. And Matthew, you know that Matthew's self-loathing is infinite after what he's done to these two women.
And again, as you were saying earlier, I will not say anything and I'm not going to jump ahead. But there's much more that Matthew has on his 1500 plus year mind than those two women. But this discussion right now is about women he's been in love with. So that is why it's limited to these two. Now that would be enough for any soul to have to carry. But Matthew has 1500-ish years of stuff to carry. And these two women represent only a small part of that. But because this conversation was about women he loved, that's why those two came up. But absolutely, what a question and what a friend. I mean, he's just acceptance. He's the best type of friend. He's the friend that everyone needs.
Yes. And also, how tragic is to learn about Matthew's past. This is the first time that we learn about sad things that have happened in his life, and there is a lot more. But oh my goodness, I felt terrible for Matthew after reading this chapter.
Definitely. It gives you a hint, just a hint. I mean, it's sad. If the only things, quote-unquote things, he had to be sad or ashamed about were these two women, that, I mean, like I said, that's enough for any soul to carry. But for us to know that he's, we don't know exactly how old he is yet. I mean, we haven't found that much out about him yet. But I love how Deb gives, of course, we want everything, right? We want to know everything about Hamish. We want to know everything about Diana. We want to know everything about Matthew. But one of the things that I love, especially, and no spoilers, I just want to talk about everything, but we can't. One of the things that I love about all of the characters and all of the books, but especially the first book, because this is where we're getting to know everyone for the first time, is that how Deb, speaking of threads, right? Speaking of threads and string, how she weaves, or I guess you would say unravels, because right now you come to it, the story is woven and she is unraveling it or explaining her technique, her weave to us. And as each chapter goes on, she unweaves a little bit more. And so now we find out about Hamish at all and a little bit more about Matthew. And one of the most beautiful journeys of this book, and again, without giving any details, is Diana's journey. And beautiful and infinite and sad, and I can't talk about it too much, not only because it is a spoiler, but because I'll start weeping. It is too tragic and beautiful and all of that. Oh, man. These books are, you want to just like dive in, and we're going slowly, which is good because I think it's important to, I think it helps savor it, you know?
Absolutely.
So that was chapter 9 of Discovery of Witches by Deborah Harkness. We were joined by our wonderfully knowledgeable friend, Laura Ventura. Now, Laura, is there anything from this chapter or even earlier chapters that was not said or that you'd like to make a mention of?
One thing that we could not cover in this chapter, by the way, I love in this chapter, it's so rich with visuals, with sense, with emotions, and even tastes. Big shout out to a blog called A Feast for All Souls. If you are not familiar, there is actually the recipe of the soup that is mentioned in this chapter, the sherry and mushroom soup. And I believe she also has the recipe for the lavender mint tea that is mentioned in this chapter.
Now, isn't her name Dandy?
Yeah, Diane or Dandy, yes.
Okay, great. And we will then also share, we'll share anything you send us, and we'll also share a link to the A Feast for All Souls.
Mm-hmm.
We definitely urge you to join because it is some of the most delicious stuff that if you're already a fan of the books, you're definitely not going to want to miss out because it just helps bring it to life even more. Well, thank you, dear listener, for joining us. And thank you, Laura, for joining us for discussing this chapter. We know it's your favorite, and we are tickled that you spent some of your very precious time with us on this Saturday evening.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Thank you for having me. I could talk about these books forever, so
you don't need
to thank me.
I know. We still thank you, and we totally understand. We totally agree. We have a podcast, and we do nothing but talk, so... We could talk about this, and we do talk about it all night or all day as well. So thank you, everyone, for listening. We look forward to our next episode.
Thank you to our generous audio host, audioboom.com. You can find our audio channel at www.audioboom.com/channel/allsoulspod. Many thanks to Penguin Audio and Recorded Books for allowing us to use portions of the audiobooks in our show. Visit our website at www.allsoulspod.com. Follow us on Twitter at AllSoulsPod. Find us on Facebook by searching for The All Souls Podcast, or email us at allsoulspod@gmail.com.